I think we're going after it the way ancient historians do. And I will just add, several critics have said that this case is so tight that you could take it into a law court or into something that would satisfy a modern historian. I mean, Howard Clark Key, an American New Testament scholar, published a book with Cambridge University Press on what we can think about Jesus. He opens the book by saying that this material in 1 Corinthians is so strong that you could take it into a law court today. So that's amazing for an ancient text. You can't do that with, for example, Alexander the Great, when the best-known biographer of Alexander writes 400 years after the fact, more than 400 years after the fact, and we say, well, we've got to take that with a grain of salt, but, you know, look, this is a pretty good account of Alexander.
Yeah.
You know, and people can't say, well, yeah, but now you're trying to compare Alexander to the New Testament. But, you know, in this early account, they act like Alexander is deity, and his mom was, you know, very special. He's the son of a god and all this kind of thing. And you go, well, see, that's what happens in the New Testament. No. The biography of Alexander is 400 years later. There is time for a lot of amalgamation, but we have the Christian report from the beginning. So you're right. This mythical theory is this is the argument that keeps the majority of scholars from taking the mythical theory.
And so we've established then that the belief in the resurrection was present in the Christian community at its very core with the central people from right from the beginning, but we need to go beyond that, don't we, to prove the resurrection? Don't we need to show that actually they weren't making it up, that they hadn't, you know, for some reason gotten together and decided to invent the story?
Right.
That in around the time that their Messiah died, you know, this was the death of their hopes. Maybe it came about because they wanted to somehow bring his, you know, he wanted his influence to live on, so they made up this story, and maybe it became real in their minds in a very short space of time. Who knows? I mean, sure. What do you say to that kind of?
Well, all of the disciples made it up sorts of reactions, and there's more than one. But there's, if you take the disciples lie, disciples stole the body, because you have to account for the empty tomb. So if you take the disciples stole the body and then they lied about the appearances view, what's often called fraud or stolen body. You know, it's amazing, Justin. If you just do this head count thing that I was talking about earlier, where is most of scholarship today? You have to look hard to find more than five scholars who've taken that view in the last 200 years. Mm-hmm. Actually, more than 200 years. And you might find just a few. And the reason they don't go there, I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons. I would be tickled if a guy went there in a debate. But the reason people don't go there is because in our world today, and for the last 50 years, there are a lot of examples of people who die for what they believe to be true. And usually those things are religious or political reasons. I don't doubt that somebody could find a case of atheists who died for communism. I think of the Buddhist priests during the Vietnamese War who would set themselves on fire over in the Far East to protest the war in Vietnam. They obviously believe something very strongly. That's the key. When someone gives their life for something, whether it's secular, political, religious, whether they're believers or not, when someone willingly gives their life, and they're not, you know, clinically depressed or something, but when they willingly give their life, we just naturally concede they believe their message. And you can say you believe it incorrectly, but you do believe it. Hmm. You're a believer in XYZ. Well, if you try to apply that kind of universal fact, if you willingly die, you must willingly believe. What you can say is the disciples were mistaken, but you can't say they made the story up. Because as far as we know, we don't have any examples of people who have recanted in the early church. We have a lot of cases of people who are martyred. Take the four people I just mentioned, Peter, James, John, and Paul. We have early accounts of the martyrdom of three of the four. And we have accounts of their martyrdom within the first century. So, and the fourth one, John, it's commonly believed among Christians that he was not martyred. Richard Baucom produces a case of a second century source that argues for John's martyrdom. So you got the big guys, the four guys on the page here, at least three of them suffer martyrdom. It's really hard to talk in terms of them making things up, and almost no critic will ever go there.
Hmm. It's just interesting. You say that the scene has changed in the last 30 years since you began your research.
Right.
I mean, are you suggesting that scholarship has become more and more open to the resurrection?
Yeah, absolutely. When I first started studying, early 70s, like I said, you'd find a chapter. You'd be delighted if a major scholar would do a chapter and would be positive. That combination, because there wasn't much. Books on the resurrection were not very plentiful, and they were often negative. And people were living in light of Rudolf Bultmann. And I tease with my grad students, I'll tell them, you can always tell a Bultmannian scholar because they will frequently say that the resurrection was the center of New Testament belief. And then in their multi-volume sets on the New Testament, they'll spend almost absolutely no time, I mean very little time talking about it.
Mm.
So how can you be a New Testament scholar? I'm not questioning that, they are scholars, but how can you center on the New Testament, say this is the center of the New Testament, and then say almost nothing about it? That's where scholarship was at that time. Right now, resurrection has come back into the central discussion. You could have a 700-page book like Tom Wright's. You can have, for example, Dale Allison, who calls himself, I just dialogued with him recently, he's a great guy, but he does a long book on resurrection, a major treatment of that. Geza Vermesh in the UK, a Jewish scholar, has recently written a little book on resurrection, and most of the treatments are positive. Here's Geza Vermesh, who spends time refuting the major naturalistic theories, including that the disciples lied and stole the body and that kind of stuff. So that's kind of where we are today, and not just that Jesus probably appeared in some sense, but there's a growing consensus that he appeared bodily. Now, you can deny the resurrection, as John Dominic Crossan and Gert Ludemann do. You can deny it, but they would still hold that the early church believed that he appeared bodily. So things have changed significantly, and I've done some, you know, head counts on this from my statistics, head counts of the major scholars who've gotten involved. And today, more scholars think the disciples really saw Jesus. Now, some of them will say, I don't know exactly what form he was in. And that's kind of a holdover. They would say that back in the 70s and 60s. Those who affirmed it. But today, more people affirm that the disciples really saw Jesus in some form, and many will say bodily, than those who deny it. It's actually a fairly large margin on the positive side today.
It's fascinating stuff, and obviously you're in a position to have really charted the progress of that over the years,
right,
that you've been working in the field. I mean, what you do, I mean, it can be termed apologetics, and that doesn't always have a very good, if you like, reputation,
right,
in scholarly circles. They see,
right,
it as a bit populist and that sort of thing.
Right.
Do these arguments actually kind of, you know, have they shifted people in their perception of belief about Christianity and Jesus and that sort of thing?
Well, I don't know what has shifted them, but there is a lot of evidence that the field has shifted. Now, you could ask why. I suppose, as it always is, the majority of people are moved when they see a bunch of other scholars going in that direction. So I think this movement, this pro-resurrection move lately, is probably encouraged by a number of people who haven't studied it for themselves, but they make positive statements because somebody else they respect, you know, a Tom Wright or somebody else, is saying, hey, this really is credible. Don't think you're you're giving up your scholarship when you do this. Well, then they can relax a little bit, and they don't have to go after it. I mean, I can tell you, Justin, just recently, I've been approached by a publishing house. I have so much material on the resurrection that I haven't published yet. I mean, I've done 17 books, 17 of my 30, exactly half. I had to count the other day because somebody needed a list. 34 books on the resurrection, 34 books, and 17 of them are on the resurrection, and I don't have that much overlap.
Uh-huh.
Well, this publisher came up to me and said, can we offer you a contract for how much do you still have on in you on the resurrection? So I outlined three volumes I would like to do, one on naturalistic theories, one on this topic we've been discussing on your show of where is scholarship today, and a third one on the evidence. We've really gone through all three a little bit. And I told them I could probably do three books of 600 to 800 pages each with virtually no overlap.
Mm.
And they just offered me a contract. I haven't taken it. I'm not sure where I'm going to go with it. But they've just offered three contracts, and they said I could have 800 pages each. Now, that's an amazing amount of data out there.
It is. It's extraordinary. And obviously, yeah, you've been at the forefront of bringing that to light. I mean, going back to people who are being influenced, I mean, even I know Anthony Flew, who we mentioned earlier. I mean, obviously, he doesn't believe in the resurrection, but I do remember in the book that he wrote with Roy Abraham Varghese,
right,
at the end, the appendix by Tom Wright, that he said of that it was the most, of all the kind of, if you like, religions, Christianity, on that basis of the argument for the resurrection, was the most convincing as far as he was concerned.
Yes, and he says that regularly. He said that when Tom and I were with him at Westminster Chapel. He said the same thing. And also from that book, at the end, now it's pretty well known, Roy Varghese interviewed Tony and took a lot of his material. What a lot of people don't know is that Tony signed off, because Roy would have to summarize these interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Tony signed off on every page of that book. I mean, he literally, as I understand, he initialed every page of the manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked him, after I saw the book, I said, Tony, are you really that open? I mean, do you say, because he says in the book, or, you know, Roy summarizes him this way, as saying, God's never talked to me before, but there may come a day when God contacts me and says, in the words of the popular American TV commercial, can you hear me now? Tony, this is God, can you hear me? And Tony said, I've never heard the voice, but I'm open. And so we asked him in the interview, are you really that open? And he said, yes. He said, I don't think I've ever heard from God, but if it happens, I'd perk up my ears and pay attention. If God wanted to contact me, I'd welcome it. And he literally says that the resurrection is the best without believing it. So there's that senility, oh yeah, you guys are pushing him. No, we're not. He doesn't believe what we believe on resurrection. And he doesn't believe in an afterlife, very firmly rejects afterlife. But he still says that the resurrection is the best miracle claim in the history of religions.
It's an extraordinary shift. I mean, his whole story is extraordinary in terms of the shift of the last few years. But it's fantastic. I've taken up a goodly amount of your time, Gary, and I know that you've got many other deadlines and things to meet. If you're listening and you've enjoyed what you've been hearing with Gary Habermas explaining the minimal facts approach to the resurrection, it's really been an extraordinary argument that's been developed by Gary in the course of his research into the resurrection. The bare facts, if you like, that we can know, that in fact most of the critical world agrees on about Jesus's death, burial and resurrection, and why from those we can deduce that the resurrection really did happen. Gary, it's been a fascinating discussion with you. Thank you for joining me on the program today. And I do hope that we have many more years of your intellect and wisdom, bringing it both on page and speaking to people in audiences around the world.
Thank you very much, Justin. It was a great interview. You asked great questions. And I was just thinking through the whole interview. Here's a fellow who understands it, because your questions just indicate that you're right there in the research, and that kind of an interview is very rewarding. I appreciate your job.
Well, thank you so much. And if you're listening and you'd like to pass this interview on to others who may appreciate it, don't forget that the web page is the place to look for that, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can find the podcast there and listen back, send it on to a friend as well. And do visit the web page of Gary as well. Gary, do you want to just give us your web page for those
Absolutely.
Who'd like to visit?
Thank you, Justin. It's simply GaryHabermas.com, H-A-B-E-R-M-A-S, GaryHabermas.com. I mentioned earlier the two books on doubt. They're both out of print, but they're both free on my website under the books tab. There's a lot of stuff on my website on the resurrection, so folks can make use of that. I hope they do.
Well, I might go there myself and download a copy. Thanks very much for being with me today.
Thanks, Justin. Great interview.
God bless.
Bye-bye. You're
unbelievable. If you'd like to get in contact with me, have a question to put to our guest, if you've got a comment to make, do get in touch by email. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you'd like to leave a phone message, it's 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. Join me again at the same time next week. We're going to be having William Lane Craig on. He is one of the foremost authorities on Christian apologetics in the world. We'll be looking at his new book, Reasonable Faith, now in its third edition. It's going to be an excellent program for anyone interested in defending the gospel of Jesus Christ. Do join me again, same time, 2:30 till 4 o'clock.